हेलो।
ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय।
ओम
ओम नमो
नमो
भगवते
भगवते
वासुदेवाय।
वासुदेवाय।
September 29, 2011, Skype class in Hilo, Hawaii. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 12, Birth of Emperor Pariksit, continuation of the descriptions of the qualities of Pariksit given at the time of his birth by the learned astrologers and Brahmins. Text 30. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. The child would become famous in the world as Pariksit, examiner, because he would come to examine all human beings in his search after that personality whom he saw before his birth. Thus he would come to constantly contemplate him. Purport. Maharaj Pariksit, fortunate as he was, got the impression of the Lord even in the womb of his mother, and thus his contemplation on the Lord was constantly with him. Once the impression of the transcendental form of the Lord is fixed in one's mind, one can never forget him in any circumstance. Child Pariksit, after coming out of the womb, was in the habit of examining everyone to see whether he was the same personality whom he first saw in the womb. But no one could be equal to or more attractive than the Lord, and therefore he never accepted anyone. But the Lord was constantly with him by such examination, and thus Maharaj Pariksit was always engaged in the devotional service of the Lord by remembrance. Srila Jiva Goswami remarks in this connection that every child, if given an impression of the Lord from his very childhood, certainly becomes a great devotee of the Lord like Maharaj Pariksit. One may not be as fortunate as Maharaj Pariksit to have an opportunity to see the Lord in the womb of his mother, but even if he's not so fortunate, he can be made so if the parents of the child desire him to be so. There is a practical example in my personal life in this connection. My father was a pure devotee of the Lord, and when I was only 4 or 5 years old, my father gave me a couple of forms of Radha and Krishna. In a playful manner, I used to worship these deities along with my sister, and I used to imitate the performances of a neighboring temple of Radha Govinda. By constantly visiting this neighboring temple and copying the ceremonies in connection with my own deities of play, I developed a natural affinity for the Lord. My father used to observe all the ceremonies befitting my position. Later on, these activities were suspended due to my association in the schools and colleges, and I became completely out of practice. But in my youthful days, when I met my spiritual master, Sri Srimad Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Goswami Maharaj, again I revived my old habit, and the same playful deities became my worshipful deities in proper regulation. This was followed up until I left the family connection, and I am pleased that my generous father gave the first impression, which was developed later into regulative devotional service by his divine grace. Maharaj Prahlada also advised that such impressions of a godly relation must be impregnated from the beginning of childhood. Otherwise, one may miss the opportunity of the human form of life, which is very valuable, although it is temporary, like others. Sa esha loke vikyata parikshit iti yat prabhu purvam dritvan anujayam parikshena nareshiha. The child will become famous in the world as Pariksit, examiner, because he would come to examine all human beings in his search after that personality whom he saw before his birth. Thus he would come to constantly contemplate him. So this is about impressions, also called samskaras. Impressions. You know, I remember, I don't know if they still do it, maybe they do, but there were some devotees who used to have a business manufacturing carved candles. So you take a basic candle shape, usually a star shape, and you dip it in different colors. So it's covered in layer after layer of colors. And then when the wax is still warm, you make impressions in it. And you carve it in different ways. And then when you light the candle and the light is shining through the candle, it shows the beauty of all the different impressions. So this is also our life. It said that man is the architect of his own fortune. But we'd all like to be fortunate, right? It often seems like it's just a roulette wheel, you know, just chance, who is fortunate and who's not. It seems like that. It seems like, well, you know, I work really hard and I barely make enough money to survive, and this other person is born, as I say, with a silver spoon in their mouth. I work really hard at my relationship and my spouse divorces me, and that person has a nice relationship. Even when I get something nice, I may think, oh, well, it just sort of happened. Of course, the human tendency is to take credit for the good things that happen to us and consider the bad things as fate or the responsibility of others. But we often wonder, I mean, how much of my good fortune, material or spiritual, is really in my hands. You know, it doesn't seem that way. It seems like I have so little control. And here's one of the keys to how to create one's good fortune and the good fortune of others, particularly children. And that is through impressions. So impressions are very powerful. They build up to create something. Just like the impressions of the knife and the candle builds up to create a work of art. So in any sphere, if you're going to have a house, each brick, each board, each window, in and of itself, may not seem very significant, what to speak of each nail. But at the end, you have a particular structure based upon the aggregate total of all of the ingredients. And if you're cooking something, so an ingredient in and of itself, and you're not going to sit around and eat flour. But when you put it all together, it makes something. And when I was cooking yesterday, one of the grandchildren was watching. You know, what's it going to be? They often ask, what's that going to be? What are you doing there? And sometimes it's hard to tell, right? Until it's done. Or doing a painting. If you've ever watched somebody create a drawing or a painting, in the beginning, it takes some time before you're aware of what it's going to be. At first, it just seems like random colors, random lines, and gradually it builds into something that's recognizable. So looking individually at the impressions of our lives and the decisions of our lives, we may not think it's very significant. But when you put it together, it's very meaningful. And particularly, Sam Sasanga Mama Virya Sambido Bhavanti Vikarna Rasayanam Kita Satyoshana Dhyatva Pavargavatam Shararatir Bhaktir and Ukumishiti Satam Prasanga, especially when one is in the association of devotees, that impression is very powerful. Right? Machita Madhita Pranam Bodayantas Parasuram Katayantas Tumam Nityan Tusantucha Ramantucha. Right? One gets an impression of satisfaction and bliss from the association of devotees. Rasayanam Kata. It's like a Rasayanam that goes into from the ear to the heart and changes what kind of person we are. In a similar way, karana guna sangasya sadasad karmiyonisu. Guna sangha, if one has the association of the ropes, if it's the ropes that are making an impression upon us, we become bound. I mean, anyone can see this in a small way. You know, we all know that the majority of criminals had some problem in childhood or some impression. And we also know the majority of people who take to spiritual life, something made an impression on them, some association, The modern capitalists understand the power of impression, and therefore they're controlling the media, the stories that are being told in the television, in the movies, the magazines, the newspapers, the novel. They make an impression upon the heart. We talked before about the power of stories, that when I'm hearing a story, that my mind accepts that the story is actually happening. And there's mental processes that occur within my mind, within my brain, that mimic the physical processes of following along with whatever's happening in the story. In other words, if the main character in the story takes off his jacket, as I'm hearing that or reading that, I go through a mental process as if I've taken off my jacket. So the stories make an impression on me. The media is full of stories. Stories of fear, stories of sex, violence, stories that material success is actual success, that having money, that having power, financial power, political power, superpowers, mystic powers, that is the key to happiness and success. So the stories are all making that impression. And then when one is convinced that, yes, if I just have enough money, enough material objects, if I have the right kind of influence, and then I will be happy. And once one is convinced of that, then they show some advertisement. Buy this toothpaste, buy this laundry soap, and then you will achieve all of your desires. And they have engineered these advertisements to make a strong impression, to show something funny or unusual, very quickly changing the scene. They get some catchy motto that rhymes and has a rhythm, and they'll show the same advertisement over and over and over again. Why? To make an impression, because they know that if you make an impression, people will act according to that impression. We may think, oh, no, I'm my own person. I'm not influenced. But that's not a fact. We're constantly influenced by the impressions we allow ourselves to be affected by. Something like if sometimes you sit on a textured surface and then your skin retains that impression. So what surface do we allow ourselves to come into contact with? That forms us. That creates who we are, creates our identity, and it creates the goals that we have in regard to our identity. And it creates our understanding of what process we should engage in to achieve the goals of our identity. Now, this process of impressions affecting the living entity is particularly strong by the arrangement of the Lord in childhood. So particularly we see this in the human form. In the demigod life, they don't have this long extended childhood. I'm sure you remember reading about Devahuti and Kardama Muni, how she conceived 9 daughters, and the pregnancy period was very short. And then as soon as they were born, they grew up. They didn't have some long childhood. And what to speak of the animal society, they tend to have also a very short childhood, maybe utmost 2 years, and generally much shorter. Some creatures have practically no childhood. But human beings have such a long childhood relative to the lifespan. If you live for 70 years, let's say, I think the average lifespan now in Western countries is about 70, 74 years. And if you say childhood, 15 years or even 20 years, that's a lot of your life. Right? About a third of your life. a little less, maybe fourth of your life. Childhood. That's a lot. What do we do? What are we doing in childhood? You know, we're not really accomplishing much in childhood. We're just preparing and gaining impressions. This reminds us of the Bhagavad Gita verse. Tasmat svad indriyam yajo niyam ya bharatar shabha papanam prajahi yajam jnana vijnana nasanam. Therefore, Arjuna, best of the Bharatas, in this very beginning, curb this great symbol of sin, lust, by regulating the senses and slay this destroyer of knowledge and self-realization. From the very beginning, agile. So this verse in the Bhagavad Gita was spoken by Krishna in response to Arjuna asking a very important question. Krishna had been describing in the third chapter of Bhagavad Gita how one can do all of one's work as a sacrifice for Vishnu. Yagyartar kamanam natra lokoyam kamanam paratam karma kanteya mukta sangasya achara. That one can achieve real freedom if one works for Vishnu as a sacrifice. Gave the example of food, yagya shishtasina santo, vinchite sarva kilbishai, vinchite te tukam papam, yo pachantina, yet pakarim. And then Arjuna said, all right, well, problem is, you know, I want to act in this way. I want to work dedicating everything to Vishnu. I want to work as a sacrifice and do my prescribed duties. But it seems that I engage in sinful activities unwillingly, as if engaged by force. Yeah. I want to do something. I want to be something. I'm thinking, okay, I am the architect of my fortune. I can create my own life. I can be who I want to be. You know, and you can go to the self-help websites and books and get yourself a really good pep talk. Just imagine your future. Just think positively. Just like yourself. Begin now. You know, so many things. I have one devotee friend who calls himself a Gita coach, and he has hundreds of books like this. You know, he can give me more books on how to create your own future and be successful than I can read in a few lifetimes. And yet, no matter which of these books we read and what coach we have and what process we do, it's so easy to do the very thing that I don't want to do, as if engaged by force. Often the very thing I'm thinking, I don't want to do this, I end up doing it. And why is that? Arjuna says, why? Why do that? You know, why when I'm trying to lose weight? Do I sit down and eat half a cake? Why do I do that? Why, when I'm trying to respect the people I live with, do I say something nasty and critical? Why, when I've made a determination to focus on my spiritual process, do I allow my mind to wander? Krishna says it's only lust. And he says, therefore, curb this great symbol of sin from the very beginning. So in this purport to this verse, I'm not going to read the whole purport, but Prabhupada says that if one is educated in Krishna consciousness from the very beginning, that love of God cannot deteriorate into love. He also says, so from the very beginning of life, one has to learn this Krishna consciousness. Because when love of God deteriorates into lust, it is very difficult to return to the normal condition. Nonetheless, Krishna consciousness is so powerful that even a late beginner can become a lover of God by following the regulative principles of devotional service. The point here is that when Krishna is saying from the very beginning, he means the very beginning of life. And Prabhupada says if one is trained in love of God from the beginning of life, it will never deteriorate into love. That's the power of childhood. Why Krishna has given the human being this extended childhood. And Prabhupada in today's verse is quoting Prahlad Maharaj, saying also, from this beginning of childhood, So even though the human form is also just some temporary illusory body, the childhood of human life gives a very unique opportunity. And again, everybody knows this, the power of impressions during childhood. There was a news article I read recently about the fact that many companies are now targeting babies. And by babies, we don't mean five-year-olds. We mean birth to age three. Birth to age three. What does their research show? I'm going to quote from their research. By 6 months of age, babies are more forming mental images of corporate logos and mascots. By 6 months of age. Babies request brands as soon as they can speak. By the time an American child is 3 years old, he or she can recognize an average of 100 brand logos. So these companies have figured out they're going to the hospitals where women are giving birth, and they're giving the mothers free Disney clothes for their newborn babies. Not for the mothers, for the babies. They've understood that if these babies see a Disney logo, see a Coca-Cola logo, see a Colgate logo, as soon as they can speak, 1, 1.5, 2 years old, they'll ask for it. They'll go to the store and say, I want the Cheerios. I want the Disney thing. By the time they're three, they can be indoctrinated with 100 logos. So why are children this impressionable? I mean, I had this experience myself. You know, many years ago, I used to run a nursery school for ages 2, 2.5 to 5. At one point, I ran a nursery for ages 14 months to 2.5. Altogether, I spent about 5 years running a nursery school. And what I found is almost all of the children who attended that nursery, went into those nursery schools for any length of time, became a devotee. I found that the power of the nursery school was greater than the power of the Gurukula. If we got kids starting at age 5, that wasn't as powerful as if we were working with the children when they were very, very young. And this modern research is showing the impression is there by 6 months of age. What the child was being exposed to from birth to 6 months, they can recognize it 6 months. Well, that's a familiar thing. That's something I like. Of course, from the Bhagavatam, we know that the child is getting impressions in the womb. And indeed, that is the subject of today's verse. Parikshit got an impression not from birth, not from 6 months, not from 2 years, from the womb. Of course, he got a very powerful impression because Lord Vishnu personally appeared in front of him. Can't get any more powerful than that. Prahlad Maharaj got an impression in the womb from Narada speaking to him. Actually speaking to his mother. There's also a lot of studies about the power of impressions in the womb. There's studies done that if parents read mathematics textbooks out loud when the mother is pregnant, the child will have a mathematical advantage and a mathematical tendency. Human beings are made to have this extended period of very impressionality. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada compared human children to soft dough. We were comparing to a soft wax candle that you can mold them in any way. Now, you may argue, well, don't children come in with impressions from previous births? Certainly. So this moldability of children is not absolute. Otherwise, King Anga wouldn't have had a son like Vena, who he was unable to mold. But in general, children are very malleable, especially when they're very, very, very young, especially in the womb and especially in the first 2 or 3 years of life. It's interesting because that's a time of life that most of us have few or no memories of. I mean, I have, you know, 2 or 3 memories, isolated memories. So So we may think of those years. So we may think, well, those years are not so important, but they are. If we look at medical studies of brain waves, we find that very young children have predominantly theta waves. That's the same kind of brain waves one gets when one's in deep hypnosis. If any of you are familiar with hypnosis, which is very much, by the way, like yogic trance, one will know that in deep hypnosis, one is very impressionable. It's almost like the accepting, rejecting facility of the mind is turned off, and things just go directly to the intelligence. So little babies are just taking in all the stimuli around them, which is why they're so easy to distract. They're not really discriminating. This is important, this is not important. That's how they learn so fast. Then somewhere around age 5, the brain starts going into predominantly alpha waves. Alpha waves are the brain waves in a light trip. And it's interesting, you know, researchers like Piaget, who looked at stages of childhood, talk about a real change that happens between age 5 and 7. That it's not until a child's age 7 that they can actually have any concept that there's more than one point of view, or that they can really understand somebody else's feelings. But the brain waves start changing at about age 5. So you have this period between 5 and 7, which is generally when we start school, generally when we teach reading. And at this age, the child still has the advantage of this sort of wide-angle lens with super impressionality from babyhood, but is also starting to have the advantage of a higher degree of focus and concentration that exemplifies later childhood and adulthood. So therefore, the child's able to focus enough to learn, but has a wide enough input to be able to learn very, very quickly and receive those impressions. So this is when we teach reading. Then after about age 7, the child is solid in alpha waves. And starting in about puberty, the child goes into beta waves, which is the normal adult position. And Prabhupada talks about these stages. He talks about until a child's 5. You don't expect much responsibility from them. A lot of freedom. And then from 5 to 10, Prabhupada said, you gradually increase the discipline and responsibility of the child. And he said, age 10 to 15, that this is the critical juncture, the turning point. We have several critical junctures. One is 5 to 7, another is about age 10, 11 to 15, 16, the early puberty. Prabhupada said, at this time, one is very much affected by one's association. One will become whoever one associates with. He said, this is the time to teach philosophy. And then he says, after age 16, then you have to just treat the child as a friend. In other words, the impressionability time is basically over. Now, what to speak of? Let's look specifically here at Maharaj Parikit's impression. So he had got an impression of the Lord himself. Of all the sorts of impressions we want to give our developing children and all the sorts of impressions we want to give ourselves as adults, the greatest impression is that of the Lord. In fact, Narada Muni tells Srila Vyasadeva that a person who has one time gotten an impression of the Lord is never an ordinary fruitive worker, because he cannot help but remember that taste again and again and again. And that's the same thing Srila Prabhupada is saying here. Now, with Maharaj Parikit, it was something that he started to develop constantly. He got an impression of the Lord, and then he was looking. Is this the person I met? And in that way, he was constantly thinking of Krishna. Prabhupada also gives this interesting example of himself. It's not very often in Srila Prabhupada's purports where he talks about himself. I haven't done a study, but it's very unusual that Prabhupada gives himself as an example, a small, small fraction of Prabhupada's purports. And Prabhupada talks about how when he was a young child, 4 or 5 years, that his father gave him deities of Radha Krishna to play with. This reminds me of when we met Prabhupada in New York. And one reporter kept asking Prabhupada, when did you become self-realized? And Prabhupada said, I don't remember any time when I forgot Krishna. And the reporter kept pressing, but Prabhupada, what age? And Prabhupada said, I don't know if I can say from the age. He said, maybe 4 or 5 years old. So here Prabhupada's talking how about the age of 4 or 5 years old, he got these deities of Radha and Krishna, which he didn't worship according to regulations. He worshipped in a playful way. Of course, we should be careful about this. I've probably personally told my husband and myself that we should not allow our child to put pictures of Krishna on the floor or in his mouth. So giving children deities of play doesn't mean that the child can, you know, suck on the deity or throw the deity on the floor, etc. But in other words, the child isn't worshipping according to full regulations. You know, I've seen a number of homes where the parents have an altar and then the children have a little altar. And they take care of their deities with respect, but not according to all the regulations. And Prabhupada says, how did he worship his deities? Well, he said he did it with his sister. And he said he did it in imitation of the Radha Govinda temple that he went to, he says, Prabhupada, here constantly. One assumes by this he means at least once or twice a day. That once or twice a day he's going to the Radha Govinda temple, I think it was across the street, and then he would come home and he would imitate with his own deities, and he imitated all the festivals. He would copy the ceremonies. So particularly in Indian temples, there's a lot of ceremonies. Recently, we're in Sri Rangam, and I think they have 340 days a year where there's some sort of festival. There's so many festivals. So Prabhupada was imitating these with his own deities. We know specifically how he liked the Rath Yatra. And Prabhupada says here that his father would help him. It says, my father used to observe all the ceremonies befitting my position. So his father would assist him in observing all these festivals with his play deities. Now it's also very interesting when Prabhupada says here, later on, his activities were suspended due to my association in the schools and colleges, and I became completely out of practice. So this sort of example is repeated throughout the Shastra. In fact, with Maharishi Parikshit himself, and later on it's indicated when he actually gets cursed by Sringi, that although he was a great devotee, he'd become attached to his family and position. With Maharaj Priyavrata, we find a similar situation where he was a renunciate. He very unwillingly took up rulership and family life under the order of Brahma and Narada. No, not Narada. Brahma and Swayambhuva Manu. And then he felt he'd become attached to his wife, Vihirshpati. And then again, he took up his spiritual practices. So this sort of pattern, of course, the most extreme example is Ajamila. That Ajamila had a spiritual youth, and he became not just some mild attachment in the midst of a very pious and devotional life, but Ajamila became a criminal, a rogue in every respect. And we find this is a pattern that we see, that a person will be raised as a devotee, get those impressions, and then through various circumstances, here Prabhupada says, due to my association in the schools and colleges, I became completely out of practice. So I've heard Prabhupada talk about this before, you know, how he was so absorbed in his studies. And then, at the right circumstances, of course, Srila Prabhupada here says he rekindled his practice in his youth, not very long afterwards. It was a brief time. And then when meeting his spiritual master, he again picked up his practices. And then he says he picked up his practices from childhood now in a regulated way, following Vaidhi Bhakti, which he says he did until he left family life. So when Srila Prabhupada took Vanaprastha life, he did not take his deities with him. That's actually the typical procedure, is that the Vanaprasthas and the Sannyasis are not worshipping the deities. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada explains in Chaitanya Charitamrita that traditionally the Diksha Gurus were all Grihasthas. Because Diksha, one of the five elements of Diksha, is worshipping the deity. And generally, it was only the grihasthas who were worshipping the deity. Of course, Prabhupada remarks that it's possible for a sannyasi who's a Vaishnava to be a Diksha Guru, because a Vaishnava sannyasi is also engaged in worshipping the deity. But according to Vedic regulations, it's the Grihastha who becomes the Diksha Guru. Anyway, here we see again the power of impressions in childhood, that if impressions are given, you know, when Prabhupada says he fell out of practice in the schools and colleges, so we would assume there that he was, by school, he would mean maybe secondary school. So that brought these impressions were there mostly, again, when Prabhupada was very, very young. Very, very young. And even though he got negative impressions while he was still in childhood or adolescence, the impressions from the way Prabhupada is describing it here, we may look at this ourselves and describe it as Leela, but let's look at it right now, just literally from the way Prabhupada is describing it. That a child has these impressions at a very young age, and then even in their older youth, gets a contrary impression that comes back to what came as a child. So again, we have critical periods for a child, the time in the womb, the critical period for impression, very, very young, until the age of 7, and then again, somewhere starting in around 10 to 12, until age 16. The juncture between childhood and adulthood. That process of puberty one is also very impressionable. So all these impressions build to form who we are, who I sense I am, my identity. And identity means that I have a particular goal and a particular way of acting built into that identity. You know, if I believe that I'm an American, if those are the impressions I got, well, Americans care about democracy and freedom and individual striving. And that's part of the identity of an American. And the goals of an American are to achieve social justice and equality, prosperity, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's the Prayojana of an American, to have that for everybody in America and everyone all over the world. And then there's the Abhideya for an American. How do you achieve that? You achieve that by buying things. What was it after the Twin Towers were bombed? So former President George W. Bush gets up and says, everybody go shopping. So you achieve that by consumerism, by charitable work, by military intervention, by political involvement. So all these impressions, that's just an example, all these impressions serve to give us a sense of identity, and wrapped up in that sense of identity is what is my goal and what is my process for achieving that goal. So am I the architect of my own fortune? Is the thing that happened to me just by lady luck? My mother used to sing a song, luck if you've ever been a lady to begin with, luck be a lady tonight. Is it just lady luck? What kind of person I am, what kind of habits I have, how I behave, who am I? What do I believe is success? How do I believe we can achieve it? Is it just luck that forms a person in childhood, myself and my own children? Or am I the architect of my own fortune? So what's interesting is that the association around me will form me, but I have to choose my association. The kind of fabric that I put my legs on will form an impression in my legs, but I've got to decide what kind of fabric I sit on. And those of us who are parents or teachers, we have to decide what kind of impressions we give to our children. So what am I allowing to impress me? What association am I choosing? What do I read? What do I look at? What kind of people are my intimate confidants? What thoughts do I dwell on in the mind? There's that old Native American story where the grandfather says to the boy, There's two dogs fighting in my mind. One of them says to be cruel, to blame others, to consider myself a victim. And the other says to be kind and forgiving. And the boy says, oh, they're fighting. Which one's going to win? And the elder says, whichever dog I feed. So what do we allow ourselves to associate with in our own mind? What do we dwell on? By contemplating the objects of the senses, one develops attachments, and such attachment lust arises. And we're talking about how Krishna says that by working in childhood, from the beginning, we can curb this lust. What do I dwell on? What, not only what kind of stories do I hear, what kind of stories do I tell? How do I interpret my life's narrative? Am I just an unfortunate victim of circumstances, buffeted about like a boat on the ocean by the wind? Or do I have a rudder to steer, and can I control the sails to catch the different winds? What stories do I like to hear? What stories do I like to tell? What kind of person do I like to, what kind of thoughts in the mind do I like to associate with and dwell upon? How do I interpret my surroundings? If I'm like this wax candle, how am I allowing myself to be carved by the situation around me? And what impression am I giving the children? Child is the father of man. Therefore, in every society, a lot of money and energy is put into education of the children. Everyone understands, whether you're married or not married, whether you have children or not, whether your children are young, whether your children are grown up, everyone understands that what impressions are made on the children determines the whole fabric of society. And I've got to live in that society. The sort of people who inhabit my society around me, who create whatever it is, in the stores, the political system, the agricultural system, the system of art, all those people were formed by impressions in childhood. Therefore, much care and attention has to be given to how people are formed in childhood. Therefore, Prabhupada said, this gurukul is our most important project. So, you know, we do talk a lot about being careful of association. It's one of the mantras in the Hare Krishna movement, be careful of one's association. Somehow we don't talk that much about putting energy into making sure our children have the best association. You know, about a year and a half ago, we finished these Learn to Read books, which are specifically for ages 5 to 7, because we were taking these devotee children. And just at this crucial junction age, you know, the children at this age, 5 to 7, so they can't read anything themselves yet. They can only be read to. And then the books that where they're learning how to read, you can remember how excited you were to learn how to read. But children are very excited and open. And the content of those learning to read books that our children were reading were all very materialistic. You know, we looked at dozens of learn to read programs from all over the world. And the materialism is incredible. I mean, it's not just in the storyline, you know, but even the pictures. And all the reading books, we never saw anything about God. You know, they might have some book about a Muslim family, but the only difference was that they dressed differently and they had some different food for their holidays. Never showed them praying. God was just absent. One of the most interesting things I noticed in the children reading books had to do with meat eating. Now, of course, we expect that the humans are going to eat meat. But what I didn't expect was that consistently, 100% of the time, in the stories about animals, where there was a predator and prey, the prey animal wins every time, unless the prey animal is an insect. So they didn't have any compunction about showing frogs and birds eating insects. But they never allowed the carnivorous predator animal to capture, kill, and eat its prey. The prey always got away. You always sympathize with the prey animal. Never did they have the children empathizing with, identifying with, and sympathizing with the carnivorous animal. And I thought, how weird that is. You know, how do you promote meat eating on the one hand, and on the other hand, the carnivorous predator animal is evil? So bizarre. Now, what kind of impression does that give in a child's life, this sort of schizophrenic impression? So there were all these subtle impressions that the children were given. And so, you know, we worked really hard to make a reading series where the children would get an impression about Krishna. Not just about Krishna. We have stories about farming with oxen, taking care of cows, growing our own food, a whole lifestyle. Having higher values. So if we want to change ourselves, if we're thinking about ourselves, like Prabhupada said, the highest principle is to preach, but higher than that is to save yourself. So the highest principle is to save ourselves, and we should ask ourselves at every moment, what am I allowing myself to be impressed by? What thoughts am I dwelling on? What people do I like to be with? What am I watching? What am I hearing? What am I reading? What am I listening to? What do I talk about? What absorbs my attention? Like Maharishi Burkitt here, Krishna was absorbing his attention. And if I want to change the world, then I should focus on how the children are being trained. That's the key to changing society. Everyone knows it. It's an open secret. The Disney marketers know it. They get the kids the day they're born. Take this shirt with a Disney logo. If I want to change myself, look at my own impressions. If I want to change the world, focus my energy on the impressions that children are getting. What kind of education are the children getting? What kind of toys do they have? What kind of books are they reading? What kind of stories are they seeing? How are they being molded? Therefore, Prabhupada says it's our duty to open educational institutions all over the world so that children may be trained from a very young age. And then you may object, well, but we've seen that when we train the children, so many of them leave. And therefore, we come right back to this purport, but that impression is there. Even Srila Prabhupada said he got completely out of practice, not to speak of anybody else. But again, as soon as the opportunity is right, that impression from childhood will again manifest itself. So what impressions am I giving myself, and what am I doing for the education of the children in society? I mean, it can be a small thing, a very small thing. You see a child at a temple or a program, smile at them. What impressions are you giving them? It's not just that you have to build schools or print curriculum books or spend millions of dollars. When we have gatherings with devotees, how do we treat the children? Are the programs at all geared for them and their interests ever? Do we tell them to get out? Or do we make them feel welcome? Do we show them how spiritual life is working? Do we give them valuable and meaningful service as soon as they get to be 11, 12 in the community of devotees so that they actually feel valued and have meaningful engagement? These are things anybody can do. Anyone can at least smile at the children. Oh, nice to see you here. And if we do these things, then we will attain the goal of life and all of society will be transformed. So thank you very much. I always like it when Krishna gives me a verse about children. So any questions, comments?
So for those I unmuted everybody on free conferencing. If there's any questions or comments on either platform, please go ahead.
Great class. Does anybody know if those original deities of Prabhupada are still around?
I believe that you're in Mayapur.
So there, it wasn't Radha Madhava. It was a smaller set of deities, correct?
I'm not sure then. I was told that they were being worshipped in Mayapur, but I'm not sure.
Because Radhana was given some deities in New York, right?
It was New York in 1976.
And
the top, where Prabhupada's room was.
They're very small.
Yeah, it was Kamal Krishna that asked me to take care of them.
Huh. Do you remember their names?
Hare Krishna, Mother Irmala.
Hare Krishna.
Hey, yesterday, my daughter turned 35.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I had made a big cake, and after work I had gone to her house to celebrate her birthday, and as we were putting the candle on the cake, she said, I think she said to me, Mom, remember Govardhan Hill? So these impressions that you're talking about, and it took me back to when she was 5 years old at the Honolulu Temple. And the Govardhan Hills that we used to have there, I used to help make them, and she used to help me. So the cake was so big, it reminded her of Govardhan Hill.
Very nice.
What did you do with the children in the nursery school?
Well, we would have kirtan. We would do little artik. I had a basket of plastic, different color and shape beads. That one basket of beads cost me $300, I remember. And I had plastic strings with knots on one end. And the children would make necklaces. We called them garlands out of the beads. And we talk about colors and patterns. And then we'd offer the necklace to a picture of Krishna. And then again, we'd take it out and make another one the next day. We had Play-Doh, and we would make offerings. We would make little plates and cups and little food, and again, offer that to the picture of Krishna. Probably once a week, we would watch a video of one of the puppet shows from that Nisinghananda put together, Burjan and Jagatarini did. I also had Jagatarini make puppets. So I paid her to make puppets, and I had some other people make puppets also. And I would do puppet shows for the children of Krishna's pastimes. We had Krishna puppets, we had all Ramlila puppets, Mahaprabhu puppets, and we would do different pastimes. Then we did dramas. We had just a box of various cloths and a few props and a little bit of makeup. And we would take it with a story, and the kids, we dress the kids up really simply. And then I would give them parts and actions to say they would repeat. You know, I'd say, okay, say, Dear Krishna, I'm writing you this letter. And the child would say, Dear Krishna, I'm writing you this letter. And I tell them what to do. And they would act it out. What else do we do? And then we just did ordinary things like playing with blocks and running around outside at the park. Sometimes we would play Krishna conscious games out at the park. There's that book of Krishna conscious games. What else do we do? I had a whole paper that I wrote up on it. And Nataka Chandrika wrote a book from the very beginning that incorporates a lot of the nursery school stuff. I will say, hands down, without question, that my 5 years teaching nursery school were the most wonderful, was the most wonderful service I've ever done. Absolutely wonderful. Nothing, there's no service I've done that comes anywhere close to that experience. Because I could spend, 4 to 6 hours a day absorbed in Krishna and Krishna Lila. And that was my service to do that. We would teach them songs about Krishna's pastimes, like blue sky, white cloud, Krishna and Balarama flowing their cows. And I would teach them songs. They all learned Paramakorna. They learned a lot of the Brahma Samhita. It would take a long time to teach little children songs, but they did learn a lot of songs.
Is a lot of this documented?
Yeah, it is. I mean, as I say, the best place to find it would be in Nataka Chandrika's book from the very beginning. I just have some sort of assorted papers, which I gave her, and she's the one who put it into a book. And Prabhupada said, with little children, you change often. So, the principle is you change activities while they're still enjoying it. You don't wait until they're frustrated and then change. Every 15, 20 minutes, we'd have a new activity. And, you know, we'd shift from quiet individually done activities to quiet group activities to more energetic activities. Oh, we also used to do Vrindavan races. So the kids would get at one side of the room. Maybe I should just go back to being a nursery school teacher. Kids would just go at one side of the room. And they would each become some person or animal in Vrindavan. And taking some motion and sound related to that person or animal, they'd go to the other side of the room and then back, and whoever would get there first would win the race. So somebody would be a cow, somebody be a peacock, somebody be a gopi, somebody be a cowherd boy. We used to do that. We had different kinds of action games, a lot of variety. Of course, we also served them prasadam. I used to cook for all the kids. You know, so I'd come back from the morning program and I'd cook for the kids and take them in the afternoon. Sometimes I took them in the morning. But it was really nice. You know, if you just go up to adult devotees and you say, wow, you know, Krishna didn't know what to do when his friends went into the mouth of Agastara and he's standing there trying to figure it out, they'll kind of look at you. You know, it's funny because we're in the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, but I don't find too many adult devotees that just sort of talk about Krishna. I find it to be more rare. It's like we're also afraid of being a sahajiya, you know. It just doesn't happen. I mean, how often does it happen when you're in the sangha with devotees that they say, wasn't that pretty amazing when Puchana became 12 miles long and knocked down all the trees and Krishna's just playing on her chest? I mean, who goes around but with the children? That's what you're supposed to do. That's what everybody expects you to do. That's your service.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's what you're doing all day, every day.
Nice.
Yeah. And everybody loves you for doing it. And doing nursery school is also such an unpolitical service. You're very unlikely to get criticized by anybody. And the expectations of everybody are really low. They just expect you to keep the kids busy and happy. You know, they don't really expect children are going to be studying rocket science and worrying about whether or not they're getting a degree that'll take them into Harvard when they just have a nursery school. So it's definitely from every respect, I mean, the downsides are, you know, some of the kids will pee on the floor and have a temper tantrum. That's pretty minor. Pretty minor. You can also get the facility for a nice nursery school with a minimum amount of money. We used to charge the families $1 per family per day, and that was enough to buy all the supplies that we needed.
Wow. Nice.
I have a question.
Yes.
First of all, I have to say that I'm always astonished at the depth of the information that we're getting. It's really, really very, very important, these classes. However, I need to ask a question that's kind of not so much focused on the gist of what you're saying. But you just happened to mention at one point in your presentation about how there's these self-help books, how you can create your own future. You've mentioned these before in some of your lectures. Now, for myself, I became a devotee fairly young, when I was about 16. But by the time I was in my early 20s, up to probably mid-30s, I was really reading a lot of these books. I mean, I had shelves of them. And then by that time, I just kind of just gave up on it. And then later on, you know, when I think I became more serious about my spiritual life, I look back on those books with kind of disdain, thinking that, God, I just wasted my time those early years with these self-help books. And my mentality was that this was more like trying to force the hand of destiny. And my goals at that time were not very Krishna conscious. You know, they were just materialistic. But since you've mentioned them a few times, how can these things, or should these things, be used in Krishna service?
Well, there is a way of dealing with the material energy so that one is more materially happy. We don't deny that. Krishna gives a lot of instruction in the Bhagavad Gita. He gives a lot of faith in the Bhagavad Gita to the modes of material nature. And in fact, what's always astonished me, and I've never really got a clear answer on this, is that in the beginning of the 14th chapter, Jesus says, this is the best of all the knowledge I've given you up till now. And he's talking about the modes of material nature. And you're just thinking, huh? You know, wait a minute, what about the middle six chapters about bhakti? What about manmana bhavamad bhakto at the end of the ninth chapter? How is the modes of material nature, which is about material energy, how is this the best knowledge given so far? As I said, I don't have an answer to that question. I have ideas. I don't have something I'd say as a definitive answer. But the point is that we do give this knowledge. We do say that you will experience material life differently depending on what mode or combination of the modes you allow yourself to associate with. Now, you could say, and all self-help books, if they're good, are trying to bring you up to passion or goodness from ignorance. That's, otherwise, any self-help that works is going to be trying to bring you up to a higher mode. That's basically how it has to work that way. Because the closer you are, this is nice explained in the Bhagavatam also, that where Krishna is accused of being partial, and the answer is that Krishna is impartial, but everything favors the mode of goodness. The closer you are to goodness, the more materially successful you are, the more material happiness you get. The mode of goodness is characterized by happiness. If you want to be happy, you come to the mode of goodness. So there's a lot of attention in the Shastra to that. It's not that we ignore that. And the main reason that we pay attention to that is not because we're trying to become materially successful and get, you know, gold shackles instead of iron shackles, but because the mode of goodness is also a jumping off point for Krishna consciousness. Shakti Thakumar has one time compared it to an airport. So if I go to the airport in Hilo, I'm still on the big island. But the only way to get off the big island is to go to the airport. You know, I can't just go to the top of Mauna Loa or Mauna Kea and jump. I've got to go to the airport. I've got to go to the boat dock. So, of course, bhakti is independent, ultimately, and one can achieve pure bhakti even directly from the mode of ignorance, just like Magrari the hunter did. But even then, we find that Narada incorporated some aspects of goodness. He didn't say go on hunting animals and just add the chanting of Hare Krishna to it. Of course, that was told to Valmiki, just chant Mara, Mara, Mara. But sometimes it happens that a person goes directly from ignorance to bhakti, jagai and madai. But generally speaking, one has to have a foundation of the mode of goodness. Therefore, there's two seemingly contradictory verses in Bhagavad Gita. One that says, even if you're the most sinful of all sinners, you can cross over this ocean of material life. And the other that says only those who've been pious in this life and in previous life will perform devotional service with determination. So generally, one needs a background of piety. Generally. One needs to be living a pious life. Therefore, no meat eating, no illicit sex, no intoxication, no gambling. Can you become a pure devotee of Krishna if you're breaking those principles? Yes. They're material. And bhakti is not dependent on the material situation. They were pure devotee prostitutes in Dwarka. It's possible. But it's unlikely. So we're interested in people coming to the mode of goodness because it's a springboard for bhakti. And coincidentally, it just so happens, not of course just so happens, but there's a reason for it, that the more you come to the mode of goodness, the more happy you are even from an illusory perspective. The nicer your relationships will be with your spouse, the more easily you will gain the material facilities and opulences that you want and need. Yes. That's the fact. Therefore, all throughout the books, Prabhupada talks about how a Krishna conscious society is also a materially happy society. Well, it's all over the place. So many purports. That if there's a Krishna conscious society, that husbands and wives will get along, that people will be healthy, that children will respect their parents, people will live a long life. There'll be sufficient agricultural produce without a whole lot of hard endeavor. There'll be sufficient rain. There'll be gemstones at the surface of the earth. You don't even have to mine deeply for them. The weather will be pleasant. Everybody will have sufficient prosperity. There won't be unemployment. There won't be starvation. I mean, how many times does Srila Prabhupada tell us, how many times does the Shastra tell us that a Krishna conscious society is also going to be a materially pleasant society? The problem comes, one problem comes, if one tries to have a materially pleasant life but doesn't realize that the purpose of coming to the mode of goodness is to achieve Krishna consciousness, not just to come to the mode of goodness. That's one problem. Another problem is that a lot of the people writing these self-help books don't necessarily understand. Mode of ignorance, you get things backwards. In the mode of ignorance, you think what's good is bad and what's bad is good. In the mode of passion, you get some things right and other things wrong. In the mode of goodness, you actually see things in the right perspective. So if the people writing these self-help books and producing these self-help courses, if they themselves are not in the mode of goodness, then their ability to see things clearly is compromised, which means that some of their instruction is good and some of their instruction is wrong. Now, that doesn't mean that everything they say is of no value. Srila Prabhupada would quote his college professors and British poets. So did Bhaktisiddhanta and Bhakti Vinod. You know, we find Prabhupada would quote Bengali sayings, for example. So it's not that that we reject everything. Just, you know, someone who's a materialist, Chanakya Pandit was a materialist in the mode of goodness. He was not a Vaishnava, not a pure Vaishnava, certainly. So one has to be able to find gold in a filthy place, and certainly one can take some help from people who've understood something as to how to deal with the material energy. I mean, a very simple example for me is that Srila Prabhupada speaks in many places about an ideal relationship between husband and wife. But his speaking is mostly in generalities. He's mostly speaking about principles. Like he says that the husband should take care of his wife just like he takes care of his wealth. He should keep it under his personal supervision, and the wife should always be beloved and on the chest of the husband. Now, that's obviously not literal. It's not that a man is going to just, you know, walk around 24 hours a day literally embracing his wife. I mean, it'd be hard to even eat and take a shower like that. But it doesn't mean that literally. It's talking about a principle, how the husband should deal with the wife with a lot of affection and care and really cherish her. But what does that mean? You know, how do you do that specifically? You know, how do you deal with it when the wife says, you know, you've just been reading Bhagavad Gita all day, every day. You haven't done anything to take out the garbage. Well, how do you respond to that? What do you do? How do you show your wife that you're affectionate to her and cherishing her and protecting her in that particular sort of situation? So for those sort of questions, I find that these books can be very helpful. They can actually say, they can get into the details and get into some application details. Just like Prabhupada talked about how you don't need courses to teach a young girl how to be a good wife. She just needs to associate with people who are good wives. So they don't have to be devotees. When you talk about the chaste women in the scriptures, Mandodari, who's not a devotee. So in the same way, there can be materialistic persons or pious people or who give examples of being a good wife or good husband, a good business person, a good ruler, a good teacher. You know, so if I want to be a good teacher, I can learn from other teachers. They don't all have to be Hare Krishna devotees. If I want to be a good wife, I can learn from good wives. They don't all have to be Hare Krishna devotees. And I just have to have the grounding in the Shastra and the grounding in my sadhana to be able to discriminate. If I become absorbed in these sort of things and neglect my Krishna consciousness, then I've missed the whole thing. And as far as playing with fate, we are the masters of our own fate. We are enjoined to choose to live a life that's in the mode of goodness. In addition to choosing to be Krishna conscious, we're told to do that. That's part of our responsibility. Now, again, one can directly take the Krishna consciousness from the mode of ignorance, and the mode of goodness will naturally develop as a byproduct of Krishna consciousness. But we are also told to make a determined, purposeful effort to live our lives in the mode of goodness as part of our, to enhance and accelerate our Krishna consciousness. That's a long answer. And I still only said a hundredth of what could be said.
I guess when I would read these books, I would actually notice, like you mentioned, that, yeah, they're bringing you up from the mode of ignorance, usually the mode of passion. But then what I would almost consciously be doing is trying to get myself in the mode of passion.
Well, if you've got a self-help book that's bringing you from ignorance to passion, and you want to be in the mode of goodness, then that's not terribly helpful. You want something that's going to bring you to goodness. It's really interesting. Several years ago, one devotee, a GBC man, by the way, asked me to look at a book and a video that's supposed to, you know, how to bring yourself prosperity. And it was very interesting because a lot of it was really about the mode of goodness. How to be faithful, forgiving, kind, you know, the divine qualities that Krishna mentions in the Bhagavad Gita. Now, the book also talked about, the book and video also talked about envisioning what you want. But that's true. Whatever, you know, yam yam bhapi saram bhavam, swajachan te kalevaram. Whatever you think about, not just at the time of death, whatever you think about, that's what you'll achieve. That's what you'll become. That's our philosophy. True. So I found it to be basically true. Whatever you think about is what you're going to become, what you're going to get, what situations you're going to be in. Maybe not in the next 5 minutes. Maybe it'll be after five lifetimes, but still, whatever you contemplate. Whatever is the absorption of your mind, that's what you become. And if you really want to get things that will bring you happiness, if you want to contemplate the right kind of things and get them quickly, then you have to develop the qualities of goodness.
Mm-hmm.
Have to become a forgiving, grateful, joyful person. So I found that all to be true. I mean, their problem was that what they wanted you to contemplate was all material. Another problem was that they admitted that there was some other divine agency, but they were talking about it very impersonally. You know, they were almost propagating a karma mimamsa philosophy. Like what Krishna explains to Nandamars, when he says, you know, if you just do your duty, you'll get everything. You don't need to worry about pleasing the demigods. So I found that, I mean, and it's to be expected. We're in a secular society, you know, and if you really write that that the way to get what you want has to include sacrifice for Vishnu, then maybe they won't sell any books. You know, so they talk about the general way that the universe and reality are geared to give you what you want. But they don't talk about that that's a person. It's not like just some vending machine. Nityo nityanam chaitanas chaitanam eko bhavanam yo vidadati kaman. Among all the eternals, there's one eternal. Among all the living entities, there's one living entity. Eko bhavanam, one among the menti, yo vidadati kaman. He's been giving everyone everyone's desires. This says Nisha Upanishad, the self philosopher who's been giving everyone's desires since time immemorial. So it's a question, it's a fact. If you focus on what you want and you become the kind of person who can deserve that, you will get it. That is our philosophy in a nutshell. Concentrate on what you want and become the kind of person who deserves to have it. You will get it. So what they're missing is you're getting it from a person. You're not getting it from a machine. And if you understand the science that we get whatever we focus on, then the next question should be, what's the best thing to focus on? What's the best thing to get? On what should I put my attention?
Mother Irma, thank you so much. I'm glad I asked the question. I'm glad you took the time to answer it so completely. Really appreciate it. I'm sorry, I had to mute two other people. I'll unmute you now.
But that, you know, that's the basic thing that's being talked about in today's verse and purport. What you focus on, what you do, what impressions are made, that's what you become. That's the whole science. That's it. You want to just put it in a nutshell. Always remember Krishna, never forget him.
Okay, we take one more quick thing. Anything else?
One thing I thought of when you were going through the purport and explaining some of the impressions, that books, Prabhupada was very much into books, and even though there's video culture everywhere now, there's something about books. Even the publishers, they generally proof a hard copy.
Yes.
Try to proof it on a computer.
Hold on, just...
So, spiritual life means repetition, and a book, you can go over and over again. And so there has some advantage over video.
Yeah, it's interesting. Oh, I was just thinking how Prabhupada did want the doll exhibit.
Uh-huh.
And he told Bhardwaj, he said that one doll exhibit was worth, you know, more than reading the book. So I see both things. You know, I have an electronic book reader, and I can definitely say that having a book in my hand is a different experience. But anyway, I see that it happens through all media. But I would definitely say, you know, don't forget about books. Don't forget about books. Be careful what you read and put energy into making books for children like you've done. Make books for children. Make books for children. Do something to change the impression from the children.
Where can I get this book, this nursery book?
Krishna.com sells it. It's called From the Very Beginning. And the author is Nanika Chandrika, who's a good friend of mine.
And you quoted a verse and a purport to educate. What verse was that?
Which, about that the face of the world will then change automatically?
Yes.
That is 4:12:23.
Thank you.
I'll read the purport here. What was possible for Dhruva Maharaj is possible for anyone. Any 5-year-old child can be trained. Within a short time, his life will become successful by realization of Krishna consciousness. Unfortunately, this training is lacking all over the world. It is necessary for the leaders of the Krishna consciousness movement to start educational institutions in different parts of the world to train children starting at the age of 5 years. Thus, the children will not become hippies or spoiled children of society. Rather, they can all become devotees of the Lord. The face of the world will then change.
Nice.
Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Thank you, Madhur Mula Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Hi.
Hare Krishna Prabhupada.
Haribo.
Haribo. Haribo.